What were you doing before you were drafted?
Well, before I was drafted, I was trying to keep from being drafted, as most young men were in the late 60s. I was drafted in 1966, graduated from high school in Lansing, Michigan in 1964. And gosh, by the time I was 16, I was working for UPI and the Detroit Free Press by the time I was 18, writing and taking pictures in Lansing.
UPI, some people might not have heard of it.
United Press International, and I was taking pictures. It was a pretty heady thing to go to Michigan State basketball games as a high school kid, shooting pictures and seeing them published in the New York Times and Chicago Tribune and all the papers that, you know, covered Big Ten sports.
So why didn't you just stay in college, keep freelancing like that, and not go to war?
Well, that's what I did, is I kept freelancing, and I was chasing tornadoes and major news stories and having fun and making more money than anybody else my age. I flunked out of Michigan State in the spring of 66.
So you got drafted. You went to Vietnam in 1967. I think it's fair to say that very few people experienced the war quite like you did. What was your job?
Well, I was the public affairs officer for the Transportation Command, and that was Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. We managed all of the in-country shipping, whether it be air, sea, or trains, for supplies and things.
You were military PR.
Absolutely. Yep. I had a colonel that wanted to be a general, and he went through the personnel files and, unbeknownst to me, found a letter that a lieutenant colonel at Fort Knox had stuck in my file, and it said that Private Frazier would be great to have on your staff as a public relations guy.
So you had the opportunity to travel all over Vietnam almost like a tourist or a travel writer would today, but with fighting going on all over the place. How did that make your perspective different from other people with more traditional military jobs?
Well, most of the guys went over, and they were literally stuck in either a base camp or out in a forward observation post or someplace like that. And that's pretty much the way they spent their year. Since we ran the shipping and transportation, I was able to hop a ride about any place and go from the DMZ to the Delta taking pictures, and it was fascinating.
What kind of things did you write about?
Oh, I wrote about we had a rock-crushing operation in the Delta that they barged crushed rock in to make airfields. Up in the highlands, it never happened while I was there, but we had planned repeatedly to ship a couple of elephants for a mountain yard tribe to haul them by air to relocate the tribe. And I have no doubt that that's the basis for the movie with Danny Glover and the Dumbo drop.
Do you have any proof of that?
No, I have no proof whatsoever. I did send the memos to the wire services to tell them that it was planned and we were going to do it, and it got put off several times, and finally I came back to the States before it ever happened, but it sure looked familiar to me.
You traveled with and photographed George Romney on a visit to Vietnam. He was the father of a presidential candidate and a presidential candidate himself at one time. He was also someone who had strong opinions on the war. How did traveling with him affect how you saw the war?
Well, I don't think that had much effect on how I saw it. Romney was a real hawk. When they asked him how come he changed from being a hawk to a dove, and he said he'd been brainwashed. Well, he was trying to kind of revive his reputation, and when he was running for president, he made a round-the-world trip. And I'd photographed him in Michigan, knew his bodyguard, his security guy, and I had invited them to come and visit my civic action program that I had for refugee kids. And they wrote back and said they couldn't do that, but why don't I join them for dinner at the embassy on Christmas Eve 1967, which I did. And then the next day, He went to the an orphanage up in the Highlands, gave away some money to help the orphans.
Why do you think he did that?
Oh, it was definitely to salvage his reputation, and it was, in one sense, it was an anti-war statement. I mean, it was, you know, we don't want to do guns, we want to do some good. And by that time, by 1967, most everybody had tremendous doubts, I mean, about the war, the purpose.
Did you develop opinions about the war yourself, traveling around and seeing it from so many different vantage points?
I think that I probably did more so than your average GI. We were told that we were fighting communism, and the whole thing, the term that we were supposed to use was allowing the people of South Vietnam the right to self-determination. That was the catchphrase. And, of course, today, in retrospect, the country is communist. They've got Ford Motor Company plant, Nike plants. And I've seen Vietnam at war and at peace, and I'm here to tell you that peace is better.
You were in Saigon for one of the big turning points of the war, the Tet Offensive. How did that change your experiences in Vietnam?
Well, we went from being almost tourists to being real soldiers. I mean, prior to the Tet Offensive itself, living in Saigon was almost a holiday. We were supposed to wear civilian clothes whenever possible, off duty. The Tet Offensive happened. We were not allowed to carry weapons prior to that, which seems funny for soldiers, but after that, we weren't allowed to be out without a weapon.
Some of my favorite parts of the book are stories you tell of sort of gaming the system in order to get out of manual labor or drudgery, usually to sneak off and take a nap. They reminded me of old TV shows like McHale's Navy or Sergeant Bilko. Did you really go AWOL for 3 days?
In Seattle, I did. I will confess to this day, I hope it doesn't affect anything else.
I don't know what the Army's statute of limitations is on that sort of thing.
But I had the way that worked out is I was shipped out of Fort Lewis, Washington, and we got up there, and the first sergeant in the replacement company came down the line and had a clipboard and asked for everybody's name, and he'd moved two guys over here, three guys over there, five over there, and it just didn't look like there was going to be anything good to come out of that. So I took my name tag off, and he came to me and you know, asked for my name, and I came up with a fake name, and he said, okay, you report to the bakery at 0400, and that was basically KP duty. So I went back to this replacement barracks and picked up my gear and got a bus to visit my cousin in Seattle and my aunt, and spent 3 days there and came back. By the time I got back to Fort Lewis, everybody had their boarding pass number, and I didn't have it. And so I went to the orderly room, asked for the boarding pass number, and the guy said, well, where you been? You were supposed to get this yesterday. And I said, well, I've been at the bakery. And he said, oh, okay. And so everything was fine. At that point in my life, the worst they could do was send me to Vietnam.
You met some impressive, even historical people while you were in Vietnam. But even after you were back home, you had some encounters with people who were important parts of history. Tell us about William Westmoreland and Al Thomas.
Well, General Westmoreland, of course, was the supreme commander of Vietnam. And when he came home, he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for all the military. UPI, again, the same people that I'd worked for before I was drafted, asked me to go cover the arrival of President Johnson in Detroit. And President Johnson was coming in to make a surprise visit to the American Legion Convention. So I got down to the airport, and it was much like Gowan Field in Idaho here, with military on one side, civilian on the other. And I noticed General Westmoreland was standing there. Struck up a conversation, and he asked me how long it took me to get regular. And I told him that I wasn't regular, that I was drafted. And he said, I mean regular. He said, I've had the trots ever since I got back. And We discussed how to take care of that problem was not to take the malaria pill that we were supposed to take every Monday morning for 2 months after we got back. And Air Force One landed, and he said, well, you'll have to excuse me. I need to greet the president. And the next day, all the newspapers in Michigan had a picture with me and General Westmoreland discussing the war.
That was the caption of the picture?
That was the two veterans discussing the war.
And how about Al Thomas?
Al Thomas, that is probably one of the biggest untold stories of all of Vietnam and tremendous historical importance. And I was fortunate, and I truly mean fortunate, to have known him. He was an attorney in Lansing, Michigan, and a friend of my father's. In 1945, he was a major in the Army OSS, that's the Office of Strategic Services, which is the predecessor of the CIA. He parachuted into Vietnam, linked up with Ho Chi Minh, the head of the Viet Minh, later the Viet Cong, armed them, trained them in guerrilla war tactics to fight the Japanese. The war ended. Ho Chi Minh had six letters that he gave to Al Thomas to take back to President Truman. And those things were all top secret. All Ho Chi Minh wanted was the diplomatic recognition and education for his people. He loved America, loved Americans. His hero in life was Thomas Jefferson. And it's very, very sad chapter in the history of America that we had a Vietnam War. And Al Thomas always said that if he was allowed to speak, there never would have been a Vietnam War. The items that he had, everything became declassified in around 1989. And the BBC did a tremendous documentary, which is called Uncle Sam, Uncle Ho. But for me to know that guy was just a tremendous experience. I went back to Vietnam in 96 the first time. Went back to my old headquarters, which is today the Ho Chi Minh Museum. And I presented a picture that I had taken in 67. And through an interpreter, told her I would like to be friends as we were in 1945. And the interpreter, a young lady, she said, well, Americans weren't here in 45. The curator, an old PhD professor, she said, oh, yes, Major Allison Thomas. And she took me in to show me a display of pictures with Al Thomas and Ho Chi Minh. They're the same pictures that I saw in his basement in Lansing, Michigan.
So the problem, as I understand it, is that after World War II, France wanted to go back and regain control of their territories, French Indochina, they
yes.
called it. And the United States, rather than standing with the Vietnamese people and saying they should be independent, sided with the French.
We threw them under the bus. There's no two ways about it. That's exactly what happened. But today, the Vietnamese people don't see it that way. In three visits back, I have seen some anti-French sentiment. But generally speaking, they don't have the animosity toward America. And part of that is because 70% or some number almost that high, 70% of the people were born after the war. They refer to it as the American War, by the way.
After the war, you went on with your life as a civilian. You moved to Boise to work for the Idaho Statesman, and you stayed while you made your living as a freelance photographer and photojournalist. In the book, we get all the way to the 1980s. You've been back from the war for nearly 20 years. And you make a confession that really caught me by surprise. You write that you hated Vietnamese people. Why?
Yeah. Well, in those days, basically an invader occupier, they saw us as a source of revenue, income, and they stole from us. We didn't know who the Viet Cong bad guys were or the good guys, and it was, generally speaking, they were not the people that we looked at as our friends and cohorts. But when I went to Mount Rushmore in, I believe it was 86, on behalf of Newsweek to take pictures, it was during the celebration of the Statue of Liberty's anniversary, and it was, I believe, the 100th anniversary. And I shot pictures of these people being sworn in as new American citizens, and lo and behold, many of them were Vietnamese. I took some pictures of one young lady holding up her certificate of citizenship. Just absolutely off the cuff, naturally, I said thank you in Vietnamese, Cảm ơn cô. And immediately that opened up the dialogue, and the whole family was there, mother, grandmother, and they had all come to be Americans. They invited me to their house for celebration, reception. And they were what we need as citizens in this country. They loved America. They loved the freedom, the whole thing. And that was in the 4th of July. In October, I got a package in the mail that was a paper sack, a soft paper sack. Couldn't figure out what it was. Opened it up, and it was a T-shirt from Mount Rushmore. And there was a little note scrawled inside that said, Mr. Dave, we go visit where we become American citizens to show our friends we think of you, our first American friend. And I'd lost that capacity to hate. It was fantastic. And there are several other incidents along the way over the years. And that's one of the reasons that it's taken me 45 years to write the book.
You've now made trips back to Vietnam. What do you get out of going there after all these years?
Well, like visiting the old area where I used to live in the slum, and I'd bring old pictures with me that I'd taken, and that's one of the greatest things for me to come back and see a kid that I had last seen as 4 or 5 years old, and have his daughter recognize her father in the picture and reunite us. I mean, to stand there with a guy that's in his 50s and have him remember nice things, T-shirts, shorts, from my civic action program that I did on behalf of the military, that Americans would send, donate things to the kids. That's pretty heartwarming.
Would you like to read us a passage about that?
Sure. As soon as I lumbered off the back of the small motor scooter, a crowd developed when I showed a couple of recently printed images of the locals taken 47 years ago. These folks were my neighbors when I lived amid the squalor of Bùi Viện Street in Saigon during what is known in Vietnam as the American War. Everyone wanted to see the pictures. The crowd grew. One pretty young woman clutching a baby approached and pointed to a cute little girl in the 47-year-old photo, proclaiming the girl to be her mother. Mom had died, but grandmother was still there. Another pretty 20-something in a white dress came up and announced a cute little guy in the picture was her father. She pointed him out, and it was the little guy that we called Hey Man, because each day he'd run up, jump into my arms, shouting, Hey man, hey man. He'd always managed to get some chewing gum or candy from me. He works just over there in the park as a motorcycle taxi. Would you like to see him? She asked with a bright smile. Would I ever? We walked to the park where she found her dad. He was grinning from ear to ear when she brought him over to me. He was still short after 47 years, but like me, he'd gained some weight. I was glad he didn't jump into my arms this time. By the time I left, he hadn't taken any gum or sweets, but I did give him a $20 bill just for old time's sake. We chatted, with his daughter acting as interpreter, until he got a customer and departed on his moto taxi. What a treat to see three generations some 47 years after first meeting them as mere children living in as refugees in poverty. They still live in poverty, but now they understand how poor they are, thanks to the world television and internet connections.